I'll explain in a minute.
Hi, okay, thanks for coming.
Is the mic working? Can people hear me?
Yes, not sure. All right.
Well, thanks for coming. This is the first lecture of Informatics 1 Data and Analysis. I'm Ian Stark, and I'll be lecturing it this year. There are various handouts circulating. If you don't get them during the lecture, that's fine. Come up and collect them afterwards. If you find you have a pile of them sitting in front of you, please pass them on to your neighbour. There are three things circulating. One is a copy of the lecture slides. This is printed three up with some space down the side to write notes in them if you're interested. And they're exactly as will be appearing on the screen. There's also a chapter, photocopy chapter of a book, which is going to be required reading for the first part of the course. That's fairly substantial. There's also a small A5 sheet with a questionnaire in. This is to collect some data that we can use later to analyze in the course. It's not of enormous import. You will not be marked on this. It's not for credit. Fill it in. I'll come back to it later in the middle of the lecture and explain what's required for it, but fill it in as you go. It's not of enormous importance for the data to be fantastically precise or accurate, but we do need some numbers. This is a first-year informatics... So it's a course primarily at first-year informatics undergraduates, and many of you will probably be doing the complete Informatics 1 course. Can I ask, how many of you are students in the School of Informatics? Right? And other schools? Okay. Anybody in maths, specifically? Other sciences, engineering? Okay. Anyone in HSS, humanities? Yeah. Okay, that's good. So this lecture is really introductory. It's about... there's rather a lot of admin and organization about how the course is going to run, what hours things will happen, what you need to do, and there's some overview of what we're going to talk about in the course. So it's setting the context for the more technical detail that will appear through the rest of the term. We actually start the real content, the kind of thing that's in this reading material, on Friday. Though I will have some kind of motivating details in this lecture. So this course is titled Data and Analysis. And actually quite a lot of it is about data. And the whole question is, well, what do we mean by data? What would we want to, why would we want to know about it? And once we've got it, what would you do with it? That's the analysis part. So a dictionary extract. Data is factual information used as a basis for reasoning, discussion, or calculation. So even there, it's slightly more complex than it's not just numbers. It's numbers that you have. It gives you information about something, and you've got it for a reason. You want to do something with it. Data is also information output by a sensing device or organ that includes both useful and irrelevant or redundant information and must be processed to be meaningful. This is something that will turn up in some of the examples and case studies we're considering. You might have a device, some sensing device that produces a huge amount of data, but actually you only want some of it. And one of the questions is, well, how do you know which bits you want and you don't throw away the wrong things? People make kind of distinctions between data and information, knowledge and wisdom. And exactly where the lines lie, what the trade-offs are, is not particularly clear. In certain contexts, people might make quite precise differences. But we'll talk about data as being the most general possible collection of information. And then this notion of information in numerical form. And I will primarily be concerned with information that is in digital form because this is then amenable to computation and analysis of the kind we're looking at. And one of the striking things about informatics and computing in the last 50 years is the amount of information that is now available in digital form and how it transforms it. Typical example being something like audio cassette tapes or analog LPs, those black round things that old people use for music. So that's analog, and CDs and MP3s are digitized, and that's somehow, it's a technical change, how you represent music, but it has completely transformed what you can do with it, how you can transmit it to people, how you can store it, how you can analyze it, how you can understand it. So this transformation into the digital, which in some sense looks just like a technical means to get slightly more things on your Walkman or iPod, is actually enormously important in terms of analysis and understanding data. So we will primarily be referring to information in digital format, but just because something isn't digital at the moment, don't assume it won't be in the near future, and don't assume that putting things into digital format is just a question of does it come in a round thing or a square thing. It can completely transform how we see that information and what we can do with it. We'll see some examples of that later.
Oh, and pedantry.
Data was, strictly data is supposed to be a plural because a datum is a single piece of information and data is several of them, but it's now regularly used as a singular as well as a plural, and I think it is almost in the OED now as being, the Oxford English Dictionary as being an acceptable use of it. So I will try not to fuss about data, datum, plural and singular, because people don't.
If you'd like to, you're welcome to, that's fine.
Now, all this information about, all this discussion of data and what is data, and they all emphasise the fact that you have the data because you want to do something with it. I mean, you might just be stashing it, but even then, you're possessing it. Raw data, just the bits themselves, are meaningless without any kind of context. And even when you have the context, you may then discover that some large portion of them are actually not that useful. You're interested in some smaller part. So it's really important, whenever you're considering data, also to think about, well, what would you do with it? What analysis can we do on that? Why are we collecting the data? What do we want to get out of it? What information or knowledge do we want to have from it? And so, although in fact quite a lot of this course will look like it's just about different kinds of data, structuring data, organizing it, where to keep it, how to look after it, and so on, actually at every point, you also need to think about, well, what can we do with it now it's in this form or in this structure? And querying data, getting information out of it, or arranging it so that we can more swiftly get out the information we want or more easily get the information we want is a crucial element of this. So analysis, there's only a small part of the course that is actually labelled, here we are doing analysis. But in fact, all the way through, the whole point about getting data organised and structured and so on is in order to be able to do particular kinds of analysis. So I mentioned the fact that lots of things that used to be analogue, sound recordings, video, writing, books, that used to be analogue and now digital. And so digital data is somehow more important than it used to be. There's more of it and a greater proportion of information is in digital form. And so we can look at, well, how much data is there that's stored out there digitally, and how useful is it, what's it for? So now I'm going to write on some blackboards. I'm not sure which ones will be most useful. Oh, I have to work this, don't I? Thank you. You've been here before. Okay, last time I lectured in this lecture theatre, I had to pull it up and down. So, data. So it's kind of truism, and every now and again you get articles in the newspaper about how there is yay much data out there on the web, on computers, in the cloud. How much data is there stored out there? And what do you think is giving rise to, what kinds of large data store are there out on the internet, on the web, in computers, on people's PCs? Any suggestions for what generates a lot of data? Games? Okay, where's the data on a game?
First off, on the Gold TV.
Yeah, so there's all the data that for the world you're exploring in a game is pretty high. Information about you playing the game is actually quite small, comparatively. Famously, Halo on the Xbox. So that's got a huge amount of data stored in the game for the game world. But actually, and when you play it, right, all the characters do things in that the opponents move around and there's some AI in there and it does various things. But in order to have, so this has a surprising compression artifact. In order to make it possible to record positions in Halo, so you could replay your experience through the game and so on, they could track what you did, move left, shoot, jump, whatever, but they wanted, instead of keeping the data about what all the opponents and enemies in the whole universe did, they arranged that each Halo run is actually entirely reproducible from a single initial random number. So Halo, and this was really hard to arrange the program to do it because it has multiple concurrent threads. So a particular player of the Halo game, what you do is determined entirely by you. What the game does is determined entirely by a single number. So when they record a session of somebody playing Halo, they only need to recall what was the initial number, the seed for the randomness in the universe, and then what the player did. And so rather than recording video of what you see and did, they actually store one initial number and your moves, and then reconstruct the whole thing afterwards. So actually, people storing lots and lots of runs through Halo consumes much less information than you might imagine. But yes, games have lots of data. Multiplayer online games have a lot of stored data and shared data between them and involves replication of data. Other large sources of data out on the net?
Facebook.
It's enormous. Facebook's interesting for having data connected as well, which comes up later. What things on Facebook are large? I mean, it's all very well putting your status update, but that's just a few characters. Why would Facebook have a lot of data on it? There's a lot of people. Yes, it's pictures times lots of people. About 500 million people at the moment. So in general, images take up a lot of space.
Gmail.
Mail, yes. Gmail's huge. Hotmail, Yahoo. Who here has a Gmail account? Yahoo? Hotmail? More than two accounts on these? More than three? Yeah. So, do you ever throw any of it away? No, why bother? So there's a lot of email. A lot of that email contains images and videos. Any other large sources of data?
YouTube.
You can't watch YouTube in real time because it's stuff's uploaded at vast multiples I think it's about 1,000 times. I mean, in each minute, the number of hours of YouTube video uploaded is large. Other large sources? Yep.
Scientific experiments.
Yeah, so that's a very different one. So this is kind of user-created content. This is very human interacting. Scientific experiments. So science generates enormous amounts of data from experiments. The Large Hadron Collider in CERN famously throws off enormous amounts of data. Each time they run a beam around the circle and smash it into something, they've got lots and lots of sensors picking up all the data. And actually, that comes off too fast. They drop about 90% of it on the floor immediately because there is no pipe fast enough to cope with the data coming out of the Large Hadron Collider. They drop lots of it immediately. The hope is that they've only dropped the boring bits and kept the interesting bits. No one's quite sure. And it also, a large data distribution network called the Grid was specifically set up through Europe. Well, it was a technique for fundraising to build big pipes to cope with the data that was coming out of the Large Hadron Collider and getting it to the people who were going to analyze it, or getting the people who are going to analyze it access to the data store. It's Large Hadron Collider. Astronomy generates quite a lot of data. Telescopes, very, very large, high-resolution images of the sky, possibly being viewed remotely. Biology. DNA sequencing, protein analysis, very large amounts of data being generated in biology, and not just kind of single bit stream, but also publications by lots and lots of biology researchers, pharmaceutical companies, producing huge amounts of data on experiments, which they then may or may not be able to analyze. It's actually both in at least astronomy and biology, and increasingly it's going to be in other subjects. People can do research purely inside the data. You can be an astronomer without ever going near a telescope or without ever commissioning a new picture of the sky. You can just go through existing material, or with biology, you can go through existing published papers, published data sets, looking for evidence to test hypotheses, to make hypotheses or to test hypotheses. And you can do substantial amounts of research entirely inside the data. Other large sources of data?
Wikipedia.
Actually, Wikipedia's not that big. It's got a lot of information in it, but lots of Wikipedia is taxed. The pictures take up some space, but yes, Wikipedia's a big and growing source.
Google,
yeah, so Google doesn't create a lot of data. Well, it does, but it's scouring the web and kind of multiplying it and creating indexes into it. So Google has a lot of data. Crucially, it has it all in the same place. So they have big data smelters to analyze it. Actually, one of the large pieces of data that Google has, obviously they have a copy of the web to do their search engines and index it. The searches, the logs of what everybody looks for and what they look for next and where they go after that and which ads they look at the same time is a very large data set of Google's, and it's one they're much more interested in than the index of the web. They search through that a lot. And this is large enough. That log is extremely valuable because you can analyze people's behavior and their buying behavior particularly through it. But it's big and it's a very fast flow. It's hard to analyze in real time. Any other sources? So we've got kind of user-generated, the web you interact with, the science generating a lot of things. Anything else? Music?
Yeah.
More audio of plans. There's also there's the commercial web. There's banks, credit cards, merchants. So Amazon have an extremely large amount of data. This is one of the reasons why Amazon sell cloud computing. They sell online data storage because actually they know quite a lot about managing extremely large amounts of data through their book. Through the bookstore is just the amount of data they need to keep on the books and on what people buy and what they buy next and how it's all connected. But banks actually, credit card purchase flow is beginning to be swamped by things like YouTube, but it's still a very large data source, is everything everybody buys with a card ever. And they keep them forever and they need to make sure the money goes to the right place. Mobile phones actually, telecommunications companies. So phone companies are mostly about charging you small amounts of money. That's the area where they're real. There's a whole business of setting up a phone call and mobile phone masks and selling you telephones and this kind of thing. But actually, their real expertise of phone companies, particularly anybody doing mobile, is the ability to track very small payments, lots and lots and lots and lots of them, and make sure you get charged for them. They're really good at that bit. And that's a huge flow of data. Every time you call anybody, every time somebody sends somebody else a text, you know those fantastically complex deals you have whereby you've sort of got free texts, but unless you happen to send one to somebody who's in France at the time, and so on, or they're not on the same network as you and so on. All those really complex contracts that you may or may not sign up to, you're trying to choose between, they have to manage how it works at the other end. They actually have to implement all of those and how they interact with each other. And track even the smallest possible payments, because if they can charge you for that text, you're absolutely certain they will do. So they're managing a lot of data and analyzing it as well. How much this all adds up to? I did a moderate amount of Googling to find out current estimates for this. One useful place to go to was the How Much Information report from the UCSD Global Information Center. And they have the 2009 report on American consumers, how much data they consumed. I'm not actually going to go through that, but one thing it does have within it that's useful is this table, which is to get estimates of size. And this is worth knowing. It's not directly examinable, and some of you will already know this, but it's worth having a survey of it. This is how you count large numbers, or how you count large quantities of stuff. So a byte is 8 bits. That's enough to represent a character of text. A kilobyte is about a page of text, and when I was young, that was a real amount of storage, that was. A megabyte will do you a photo, actually do a photo perfectly well if you compress it. And storage devices are kind of, some small things are being measured in megabytes still. Gigabytes, a gigabyte is 1,000 times a megabyte, so each of these is going up by 1,000. Which is actually, it looks like, just one row after another, but actually it's multiplying, it's not adding. So this increase we have is actually, I have to do this again. So this increase is exponential. This is an important concept, which will turn up in algorithms as well, that it's not just going up by 1,000 every time, it's multiplying by 1,000 every time. And exponential differences are much, much faster, or much bigger than you expect, actually, is about. Whatever you think it is, it's always larger than you expect. Because we're kind of cued into linear increases of things, and exponential always comes as a surprise. So although when your phone starts storing gigabytes rather than megabytes of data, you think, that's just this year's model, it's actually an enormous shift. But it's hard to get a handle on it. Gigabyte is an hour of video, tens of gigabytes if you're having really high definition video. So video DVDs capacity is measured in a few gigabytes. And it's now standard that a PC memory will be measured in a few gigabytes. And its disk maybe would be measured in tens, hundreds, thousands of gigabytes. 1,000 gigabytes is a terabyte. This table's a couple of years old. And so they're saying, a terabyte is the largest current hard drive. That's not true now. There are larger ones. But they're all of the order of a terabyte. It might be 10 terabytes, but they're about terabytes rather than gigabytes or megabytes. And a terabyte's quite a lot of data, actually. A terabyte's enough data that although you might have it stored on your PC, it might be quite hard to fill that up by, say, downloading from the internet. It will take a while to move a terabyte of data over a phone line. Also, a terabyte, so a gigabyte of data, if you had scientific data of some kind, or you had some videos you wanted to edit, gigabyte you can put into main memory and manipulate as is. You can jump around it really fast. Once you start getting to a terabyte of data, you can still analyze it. It could be sitting there on your hard disk. But you're not going to be able to load the whole thing into memory at once and do some scan. If you want to scan through it multiple times, that will start to get quite slow. A disk, although it might be fast, there's something physical going on. The thing's spinning, it's got a head moving. If you want to go from one place in the data to another, it will actually take longer to do if you're going from one end of the data set right to the other, or if you're moving nearby. These things start to become a concern. So at about a terabyte, you have to start to think about how is my data organized? And having it well organized can make things much faster to do than if you have it poorly organized. After terabytes, so a terabyte is a reasonable amount of scientific data to analyze on the spot. Petabytes, so there they're saying AT&T carrying 20 petabytes a day. That's a couple of years ago, so it'll be more now. Petabytes are quite large. You can store them. You can buy 1,000 disks and put that on them. The amount of data that's around, say in the university or on your hard drives altogether, you might start to measure in petabytes. But that's even harder to analyze. You could collect it, but then if you wanted to find something in it, so this is like Google looking at their logs for the last year, who searched for what. They're up in the petabytes. So the information's there, but can you get it out? So large data handlers are looking after petabytes of data at a time at the moment. But it's a challenge. That's kind of the edge of where you can analyze a petabyte of data, but you have to be very, very smart about how you do it. And various people like Google and Amazon are smart about doing it. After that, now it just gets into naming fun. Oh, I had a petabyte figure. So the Large Hadron Collider generates about 15 petabytes of data a year. That's after they've thrown away the completely useless stuff. That's what they think they can need to be able to analyze. And it's enough that in that year they'll generate 15 petabytes. It will not get analyzed in that year. People will spend years then later forming hypotheses and retrospectively analyzing the data. The data comes off the Hadron Collider, they drop most of it as being uninteresting. But every now and again, they take a sample of the whole thing, just in case later on somebody realizes that their previous definition of interesting was completely wrong. So every now and again, they keep a section of what they believe to be complete junk, because they think that's the bit where nothing happened. That's the bit where none of the particles went and nothing interesting happened. But they keep some of that, just in case. So petabytes are being handled. The next step up, 10 to the 18 bytes, is an exabyte. And exabytes are big. So here they have an estimate. In 2009, all the hard drives and home computers in Minnesota, I don't know why Minnesota, maybe Scotland will be the same, would be an exabyte. Last August at the Techonomy conference, Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, his estimate was that people were generating 2.5 exabytes a day of data and putting it up onto the web or onto the internet. So an exabyte is actually, that's about the amount that's newly turning up on the web each day or turning up on the internet. Somebody is sending an email to somebody else, somebody's putting it on their hard drive, somebody's creating a video and uploading it, this kind of thing. So there's around an exabyte, but that's everybody. Nobody's attempting to analyze all of that at the same time. And then you get to really large things. A zettabyte is what comes after exabyte. A zettabyte is 1,000 exabytes. After that is a yottabyte, which is 1,000 times further. And the name for the one after that has not yet been agreed on. There's a series, so that you could work out how these go. I mean, peta, exa, zeta are related to 5, 6, and 7 because it's 10 to the 15, 18, and 21. And then yotta is related to 8. There's a kind of logical one that would involve nines and letters near the alphabet and so on. There's also a fairly serious campaign to make it a hell of a byte, which has got surprising traction. And it's kind of sad because actually, no, one day that will be a normal figure and you have to think of something that's bigger than it. It may top out at some point. Moore's law is that, there'll always be more and more of this, but maybe not. And the Okay, so there's a thing. No, do I have the?
No.
Something called the Digital Universe Report, and an annual report on how much data there is, which I've got a link to in the blog, reckons that in 2010, there's about 1 zettabyte of data was created. So that's specifically digital data that people created for some reason and then did something with. About 1 zettabyte of data created. And interestingly, if you look at hard disk and tape sales, there's only space to store about half of that. So although you'd have 1 zettabyte of data created, half of it is transitory. People watch the video, then throw it away. So we've got about 1 zettabyte of data now being created in a year. And this report on the American consumers reckoned that in 2008, in their homes, the Americans consumed 3.6 zettabytes of zettabytes of data. And not including work, they reckon that people consume much more data at home than they do at work. So they could do all that. Because, and they have some statistical magic that shows that Americans do spend essentially no time at work at all. You'd have to read the report to find out how they get that argument. So we've got large and large amounts of data. And there are questions about this, saying, well, is it useful? How accurate is it? How reliable is it? How secure is it? Who has access to it? And you might or might not be worried about that. And equally, how much of that data there is about you? And you should be concerned about it. So which of you do not have a Facebook account? That's it. OK. Lots of you had Google and email and so on. So lots of you have mail out there in the cloud, data, not just individual pieces of data, but connections. Facebook is really interesting because of the connections it can make, the things it can work out about people that they're not expressing directly on Facebook because of the connectivity. So who can see it? Okay, other people on Facebook can see it, but how much can the people who run Farmville see? Because they can run adverts through it. How much can advertisers see when you look at certain things on Google or on the web, or Google or on Facebook? So how much do advertisers know about you and what you do and what your friends do and what your friends' friends do and so on? And also, how much of that personal data can you get access to? The answer is probably not very much, actually. Quite a lot of what advertisers know about you or Google knows about you, it's not directly accessible to you also because it's mashed in with lots of other people. Some of it will be anonymized. And it'll be about you, but they can't tell that, maybe. Okay, which I guess brings us to this data collection exercise. Later on in the course, we're going to collect some data. No, later on in the course, we're going to analyze some data, and I could just make it up randomly, but to give some authenticity to it, we're going to collect data from you. So there is this sheet. If you haven't got one, beg a neighbor who has a pile of them. And please, at some point during the lecture, circle your nationality, UK, EU not UK, or outside the EU. Accuracy is not totally paramount here. If you do not wish to reveal your nationality, that's fine, leave it blank, or just lie. If you have more than one nationality, and one is in the UK and one is not, and this kind of thing, then you can choose. Excitement. How many hours of physical exercise do you do a week? If you're not sure, it varies a lot, choose the last week. Again, it doesn't have to be absolutely precise, but please put down an answer that you think is in some way meaningful. And third, how many hours would you estimate you slept last night? Or if you want to be precise, in the last 24 hours to now, that kind of thing. We need data that's categorized. So the top one is you fall into one of three slots, and the other two are numeric, in that they're going to be numbers, and they could be larger or smaller. But there's some range within which they can fall. So please, fill this out, and then pass it to the front. It is intended to be anonymous. We're not going to trace this. We're not going to publish the data. We're not going to place any great reliance on the statistics we get out of the data, but it's merely in order to have a data set to analyze, which actually one could begin to make interesting hypotheses about, such as, does everybody lie? So please fill this out, and at the end of the lecture, pass it forward to the front, and we'll collect as many as we can. Thank you. Okay, so there are lots of things about data and how data itself is important. Actually, this course is not really about that. I will continue to make reference to it because it's the motivation for lots of it, it's the context of these things, but actually, although these issues are important and interesting, this course is really about, it's about technologies that underpin gathering, storing, retrieving, querying, manipulating, analyzing, and so forth of data. So, but even then, technologies are not going to be the focus of the course. So I'm interested in, we've got this motivation about why we're interested in analyzing data, managing it. There's lots of it. We can get interesting answers out of it, but how is not always clear. So we're interested in it, and this course will be about, that's the reason for having the course. The course itself is about how we structure and analyze that data. And specific technologies of how it's done today actually will not get much attention. The focus of the course is not on directly on individual technologies. It's not a technology-based course. It's really a theory course. It's about the principles underlying those technologies. So it might be that today, the best way to analyze a particular piece set of data is to put it on disk, to put it on the net, to load into the memory of the machine, or to stream it in a particular fashion. And I'm not specifically looking at that. I'm not going to look at particular algorithms for compressing video, or the trade-offs in storing large amounts of personal data online. It's really the principles about, well, what things are important and what things do you need to look at when you want to evaluate suggested solutions for doing these things. So the principles behind it, what are likely to be the important questions, what you need to think about, and some of the solutions generally that people propose for this and how you might evaluate them. And learning principles is in some sense more important than learning individual technologies. You do need to learn individual technologies at any time in order to implement some of those principles. They change, so you will need to learn them again in future years. You need to keep on learning them again and again. And that'll be a theme throughout the courses here, is that we'll teach you principles that we hope will last a reasonable length of time, but you need to be aware of what they are and look out for if they change. And also, and then on top of that, you will need to learn repeatedly technologies, programming languages, libraries, techniques, and so forth, that we can't teach you now forever. We can teach you the ones that are current, and you can learn about them, but it's the process of learning that's going to be more important. The principles are much more stable. They do change. There is new material, new things are discovered, but much more slowly than the specific technology of how we do something today. Okay, I'll say a little bit more about the specific areas we cover in this, but we're now sort of into administration details. This course runs for 11 weeks. We have lectures during the first 10 weeks only. The lectures are 11 a.m. Tuesdays and 2 p.m. Fridays. Actually, they start at 10 past 11. This is part of the standard university calendar to allow time for moving between lecture theatres. In particular, so we start at 10 past 11. The previous lectures are supposed to stop at 10 to 11, which gives people time to move between campuses, in particular from King's Buildings to here, if necessary. However, I don't know if that's actually going to be relevant for you people. How many people here were at a lecture the hour before this one? Had a lecture at which they should have been the hour before this one. It might be a different number. How many of you had the opportunity to be at a lecture on a different campus? So out in the King's Buildings. Yeah, okay. So we do have people who will be traveling between sites, between lectures. So we don't start till 10 past 11, but I will start promptly at 10 past. Lectures start this week. They run for 10 weeks. There's one slot, Tuesday the 25th of January, so a few weeks' time, the Tuesday slot, the university, there'll still be a lecture, but it won't be me, it'll be the University Careers Service giving their lecture. So we have 19 lectures on data and analysis, and they're divided roughly, covering three parts. Actually, the final lecture will be a revision lecture, probably where we'll go over a mock exam that you've been set, but it may be other things depending on how the course is going. Course comes in three parts, very roughly divided into structured data, semi-structured data, and unstructured data. And I will say a small amount about what those are. So, actually, let's try this one. I give up. So structured data is where you have really, really organized data. Typically in tables. So something like commercial banking payments. They would be highly structured. You'd have who made the payment, when, and for how much, and to whom. And you just have a table like that. Or university courses typically involve a lot of examples with students and library books and lecturers and so forth. You might have a table of student names and email addresses, or maybe student IDs as well. You might have a table of lectures that says given a student ID, a course they're on. So a table that says for every student, all the courses they're on. So one student may be on multiple courses, of course, and every course may have multiple students. Whereas over here, for example, each student ID will typically only be tied to one name, and so on. So structured data comes in tables. There may be connections between the tables. This ID is the same as that ID. And structured data is typically born structured. You plan some database. So relational databases, relational database management systems, will typically come as tables. You plan some layer of data, and then you fill it. All the students arrive, and they sign up for courses, and you fill out the tables. And these are really organized, and there are lots of techniques for searching them quickly, for analyzing them, for understanding them. So that's structured data. Structured data typically comes in rectangles. And it's slightly old-fashioned, but there's still a very, very large amount of it out there. And also, it's an area where we understand quite a lot about what's important and what's unimportant. I mentioned astronomy. Pictures of the sky will often be arranged in lots and lots of tables because there's a huge amount of it, and people want to do very fine analysis, and they know in advance what kind of analysis they want to do, what structure it's got. Semi-structured data is not quite so organized. It's often pre-existing material that's sort of been jammed into some format because it's grown large enough that you need to analyze it formally. Typical example of it is a web page. So web pages are, you know, there's some text, and text typically comes in paragraphs which contain lines and words, but a paragraph might in some cases be a table, or it might be a picture. Or inside a paragraph you might have some deeper structure that talks about lists of items, and each item is a little sentence on its own. So a web page is the prototypical semi-structured data. It's quite organized, but it's not as rigid as there are lines and every line is exactly the same. Usual representation of semi-structured data is as some kind of triangle. You have a top-level element, might be a web page, and then within that there are sections, within that there are paragraphs, and the paragraphs have words in. But some of them might be different. At some point, we might have just an image, a whole section that's just an image. Or down here, we might branch out into some more complex structure inside an individual paragraph. So semi-structured data typically has this tree structure. You've got a top level, and then you've got a number of things below it, which are sort of similar but might be different, and so on and so forth. Plain text in a book may be annotated, marked up to give it this kind of structure. You may say, well, there's lots of words, but they come in pages and paragraphs, and each word maybe has some data attached to it that says this is a noun, this is a verb, this is English, this is French, or whatever. So semi-structured data comes in these trees. There's a continuum here. Some things may be could be represented either in structured or semi-structured. It depends what kind of analysis you want to do, where the data is coming from. In biology, a lot of data, although it kind of should be organized, ends up with a semi-structure. So SwissProt, a big online database of information about proteins and enzymes from experiments. This gathers lots and lots of experiments from lots of people all over the world over time. And it contains data that has things like, oh, somebody discovered, analyzed the structure of this protein, and they reckon it contained these chemicals, and it's about this long, and they did it in this way, and it's published in this paper, and you can find out about it here. So that sort of information you might think you could put in a database table, but it turns out that the curation, the looking after it, is sufficiently kind of flexible that actually one of these comes out better. You have a lot of experiments, and each experiment had some results, and the results look a bit like this, but sometimes results are different. Sometimes results have the data attached and sometimes they don't have it attached. Sometimes there's a publication, sometimes there's several publications, sometimes there's a video. So that kind of data is typically stored in a semi-structured setting where we don't have as much, it's not forced into this rigid box structure of structured data, but equally analyzing it might be a little more difficult, might be a bit slower to do, or you might have to be more ingenious. And finally, there's unstructured data, which is just a blob. That just, you've got a whole load of information. So, for example, a corpus, all the words in a book. If you don't have any structure, you don't know where they are. That might be, you might just have unstructured data. You have a long list of words that's in a book. And actually, that alone can still be reasonably interesting. You can do some analysis. Or you might just have an enormous amount of numerical data that comes out of an experiment. And it's just a stream of data points over time. It has no other structure. And again, you want to say, well, how can we store that? How can we analyze it? What happens if we have a stream of values that came out of an experiment, but it's too big to fit on my disk? Then where do I keep it and how will I analyze it at all? So logs of data might form that. You know, we just know which web pages, who hit our web page when, but it's just a really, really long stream of addresses and no more detail.
Even with unstructured data, you can do reasonable amounts of analysis. And one very recent example is, now, have I got this? This paper here.
So published in December
and has created something of a stir.
That's kind of readable.
I'll see if I can zoom into it. The quantitative analysis of culture using millions of digitized books. This is a bunch of people at various universities, as you can see, involving biologists, librarians, encyclopedia writers, and crucially Google. So although there's a whole bunch of authors there, one of them is a team at Google,
who account for most of them, actually.
And Google, as you may know, have digitized a lot of books. And this research team have analyzed them, looking just at the words in those books. But there are a lot of books. They estimate they've analyzed about 4% of books, all books ever printed. And they've looked for the words in them. And they've done this, so it's, hugely contentious, because they just said, yeah, I know it was written by somebody, and it comes in pages and orders and structures, and the words are supposed to mean something. We'll ignore that. It's completely unstructured data. We've just got all the words that are written in these books, and they call it culturomics, like genomics or proteomics. And they just look to see how were words used. And they get a lot out of it. So they can, in particular, they can look at n-grams. They can look at when were two words used together, when were three words used together, how frequently were they used over time. So they've done things like look at, so you can see the American Civil War coming through. They have a graph of when references to the North and the South, and then references to the enemy in American literature through the 19th century. And there's these great lines that say, you know, you start off with the North and South being not significant, and they get more and more and more significant. People mention them a lot. And then the enemy just overtakes all of them. And they also look at fame, how long people are famous. They've taken 74,000 individuals mentioned in Wikipedia, regarding this as a measure of fame, and looking at mentions of their names in the literature. Now, of course, some of those will be wrong, but overwhelmingly, if a person appears, their name appears, you know, two words together in a book, then possibly it's referring to them. And they look at, so for particularly famous people, Albert Einstein, for example, doesn't get mentioned at all before he exists, then lots and lots of mentions, and then it drops off a bit as he becomes less of a celebrity. And so they look at how often it occurs, so somebody who's a celebrity, how fast their celebrity grows, how long it lasts, and how fast it drops off, and also how old they were at the point where it was at their peak. And so they managed to do in the analysis that for all of these 74,000 people, they reckon that through the 19th and 20th century, people become more famous, faster, younger, and then we ignore them faster. So the spikes just get steeper and steeper and steeper, which is kind of what you might think. But actually, they have the data to back it up, because they've got a very large amount of this purely unstructured data, but you can do interesting analyses on it. And there's also a tool, this thing, the Google Books N-gram viewer. You can search their data. They're not releasing the whole lot because the books are in copyright, but this they can do. So this is a search for relative use of the words Scotland and England in books published between 1800 and 2000. Well, a representative fraction of books published 1800 and 2000. I think they've got about half a tera word, as in 500 billion words. And you can see that Scotland and England initially, through the early 19th century, actually, they're pretty comparable. And then England runs away about mid-19th century, but Scotland has occasional peaks. I have no idea why. One could hypothesize why, and then do experiments to see, well, does Scotland appear in conjunction with a particular other word? Or does England appear with it in conjunction with a particular other word? You could also limit it to, actually, this doesn't offer it. They could do limiting it to words, books published in the UK or books published in the US. So I have a feeling if I do Hogmanay and Christmas.
So Christmas is a big winner in the early 19th century. Much more popular, or This is proportion of words published. So a much larger proportion of words published in the early 19th century were Christmas than in the 20th century. 20th century has kind of dropped off, but it's growing a bit. Hogmanay is below Christmas, but has a tremendous peak around the 1830s to 1840s. I have no idea what was popular about it then, but Walter Scott may have something to do with it. So, I mean, this is just a, you know, first sample tool, but people can do real research inside this, particularly if you have access to more of the data than this single viewer. You can do this kind of analysis, and surprisingly, you can do it having dropped so much of the structure. This is not looking at all at where did they appear, how did they appear, in what form, was it a book, was it a magazine, was it a newspaper, what was this word, what was it, how, which paragraphs was it in, were they close together, and this kind of thing. You can ignore all that and still get a surprising amount out of it. So these are the kind of analyses you can do with data. Right, back to course structure. So we've already seen lots of you on the informatics course doing informatics degrees, some of you doing other ones. This course is meant to be done with computational logic and functional programming last semester and with object-oriented programming this semester. And so you should all, they're strict prerequisites, you should all be doing those four courses. You'll then be doing a different combination of other courses. I'll do timing later. And yes, if you're not doing these, then your director of studies about why. You may be doing it for aware of this for a reason, but and in particular, I'll be assuming that people are also on the object-oriented programming course. There's not a huge cross-dependency, but if something appears there, in general, it'll be assumed that you have seen it there. Textbooks. There's no single book that covers all the topics of the course. There are two or three books that cover components of it, and I'll be giving out individual chapters or an individual chapter from each of them and directing you towards them. So the one that covers most of it is this book by Ramakrishnan and Gherka. Looks like that. on database management systems. It's a great big thick book, about 1,000 pages. We're only referencing maybe the first quarter of it. If you get interested in databases, it's a compulsory textbook for the third year database management course, and it's a good book. So it is worth, if you're interested in that kind of thing, it's a good book to read. You can get hold of it. If you buy the hardback copy off Amazon, it's enormously expensive. If you buy a secondhand paperback copy, it's considerably more expensive. If you go and read the copy in the library, then that's free. Who has borrowed a book from the university library? Been to the university library? Knows where the university library is? Okay, if you don't know where the university library is, then and you're sitting next to somebody who does, ask them. There are not very many copies, actually. There are a few copies of, there are a couple of copies of the database management systems, and they're in the high-use books section, which means they should be accessible, but you can't take them home for the weekend. So if you want to look up specific things, then you can do it in the library. Or you can talk to people who are on the course last year who may have copies that they're interested in selling, or buy one online. If you're interested in it. It's not a compulsory textbook. There will be some compulsory readings but for those, from books, but for those, we'll provide copies. In particular,